but I was asking you whether this was a moment when your intellectual interest began to focus.
Yes, I think I did. I think part of the fact that I read these Russian novels when I was still in Russia lingered on. No, no, what did I take it interest in? What did I take it interest in? I'm trying to call my mind back to what happened to me. First of all, what did I read? I read Anna Karenina, too early, meant nothing to me. I read Reynolds, the poetry stiff, age of 13, 14, 15. Pretty long for later. I read Talbot Baines Reed, which was school stuff. Fifth Form St. Dominic's. Give a Dog a Bad Name. These are school stories, Victorian school stories, written in the 1890s. I read the other read. I read The Cloister and the Hearth. The schoolboy reading. I stopped reading Jules Verne. I read Scott. Quite with considerable interest. Never even said me like this. I liked when I read Dickens. I read Thackeray. I did not read George Eliot. I read one novel by Bill Board. I read Peter Woodhouse. All that I did read now. Direct for interest. Yes. I think I must have begun reading quite late, in about when I was about 16, 17. I began taking different ideas. That's undeniable. And the ideas I was interested in, I read Spengler. The Decline of the West, which was an influential book in his day, must have appeared in about English translation in about 1926. I read that, was fascinated by it. Very panoramic. I read books about books. I read Hill of Murray. I read McHale, with Hill of Murray with Water.
Are these on your syllabus or off it?
Off. I would read a book on pre-Islamic Arab poetry. It was that not on the syllabus. Pre-cleric poetry, but it was up to a point.
You find these in the Pauline Library?
Yes, I did. I think it's really right, yes. I'm trying to remember, I've already forgotten what I read in those years. I like reading second order books, discussion essays, discussions of other books. I read one or two essays by Aldous Huxley, only to them. Of course, other boys did too, I suppose. It wasn't all that rare. Anatole France I read, because I went to France, we always went to France for holidays, it was easy French, and so I read that volume by volume. That's quite a lot of ideas in it. It's not just straight novels, you see what I mean. No. Like Penguin Island or Sur la Plage Blanche, these things are full of some discussions of things, because that's what you like. I have interest.
Just a time.
Essays. I read Macaulay, which I bought for myself, not the syllabus. Age of 14, I went and bought a second-hand, single-volume edition of Macaulay's essays, which I thought were super marvelous. I was absolutely fascinated by the facility of style,
yes.
By the infinite readability.
Yes.
That I loved.
That's a very odd thing to do at 14, isn't it?
I did. In that sense, I must have been a bookish boy. But it didn't show its impulse. I mean, I wasn't obviously sort of boy with a book under his arm, eventually.
And you didn't have an awful reputation as an inky swan?
No, I did not. But it's not Dinky's fault. You know, it's quite popular. Tell the boys to clear my natural anxiety to please. I think I was rather good at making friends in that sense. I think I probably entrusted myself some skill, unconscious skill, to the new life. No, that wasn't Inky's fault. Not a bit. There were Inky's faults. But I didn't like them. Or they me. But I was too talkative, too lively, too much interested in people's characters and lives. I mean, Inky's what?
Yes.
You see what I mean, you see?
Now, you... At what point does it become obvious to you that you're going to go to Oxford, that you're going to go to university, that you're not going to go
from
join your father in business?
From the beginning. My father was quite clear that I had to go to university.
Right.
And they were indulgent. In St. Paul's, the doctrine in St. Paul's in your father's day and mine was better to get a scholarship in a bad college than even if you could afford it, go to a good one. Because what they wanted was scalps, number of scholarships per annum, tremendous competition.
Yeah.
St. Paul's got a great many, comparatively speaking. They say more than other London schools. And that was the aim and intent. Therefore, the assumption of being talked to Cambridge was fairly clear. Besides which, I was sufficiently sophisticated. I wrote something on the Chancellor's English Essay Prize, which was a thing in my, when I was about 26. And the then High Master of these schools said this is more than other grades in Oxford. This is quite interesting, yes. But if you work to get Oxford, to grade two, that's what I meant. No idea what that meant. But the assumption that I go to Oxford never questioned. So that's what my father did want me to go into his business. Only at the end of it. But it's quite clear I wouldn't. Not for any idealistic reason. Mainly because I didn't understand what it was. I didn't understand what mathematics and law and bookkeeping. And when I used to get lunch with my father in the city and his fellow business acquaintances used to come, I couldn't laugh at their jokes. I thought they were awful. Great red-faced drinking men with hearty jokes. My father seemed to get on quite well with him. I realized I didn't have no rapport with these people, therefore, it seemed quite about everything else. I said he was no good for me. No, I knew I was going to Oxford. Didn't know where. But my St. Paul's life, I went to concerts, I went to promenade concerts. My mother sang, as I told you, Verdi, Verdi, Bizet, Verdi, Carmen, Puccini, roughly. Plus, the kind of opera they put on in Riga.
Mm. She'd sing at home.
Mignon, yes.
You had a piano and she would accompany herself.
That's right. That's right. We had arias from Mignon by Ambroise Thomas. Not often heard those.
And you, did you take music? Did you learn to play?
No, all the men tried to teach me piano in 7. I realized quite early that I would never be good enough to enjoy it.
Yes.
I gave it up.
Do you have any memory, just to conclude this period of St. Paul's, of becoming an adolescent? Your sexual change, becoming
Well, I'm going to tell you. I think I must have had crushes on boys. But I don't think I was aware of what it meant. The homosexuality was talked about. There wasn't any in St. Paul's, to my knowledge. But not a single one of the boys I knew. Most conspicuously, it was alleged that in the boarding houses of St. Paul's,
yeah,
mainly day school, that there were these boarders,
yes,
that there something sinister of that kind went on. But it wasn't in the forefront of attention.
Yes.
We didn't have obvious affairs. But when in my last term, there were sort of obscene boys who used to talk about how pretty Spencer was and so on.
Yeah.
In my case, I was in love with the man who offered to give a clergyman. It's clear to me now that I was. We became great friends. There was no physical contact, but we used to go to concerts together and Covent Garden together. And I realized retrospectively and I was at Oxford. So I must have been in love with him. He also came to Oxford and became a clergyman. And then preached a sermon in St. Paul's Cathedral to some Pauline gathering. I thought I'd go, see if I still had feeling for him. None. Large, fat, absolutely unattractive looking man.
Yeah.
I thought I could die.
Yes.
But no doubt I had longings in that direction.
Yes.
Girls, very faintly. Faintly. I found some more attractive than others, but I didn't know any more. My parents were friends of, and I used to go to little dances in, as it were, Bayswater. One of the people who used to come to dances with me, where I used to meet dances, is Jonathan Miller's mother.
Ah.
She was a very, very nice woman, Betty Miller. She wrote a very good book on Browning. She was shy, and she was bookish, and she was intellectual, and very aesthetic, and I liked her very much. She was not at all beautiful, or attractive, but she and I didn't like dancing. I had a great, great, I was taught it, and I could do it, but I absolutely loathed it. Again, some complex, of a sexual kind, no doubt. She didn't like it either, so we used to be asked the same sort of parties. And we used to sit it out.
Because
I was a bane of hostesses. Because I used to gather men around me and tell them stories. And then they weren't available for dances, you see. But she and I used to go to corners, have long, quite interesting conversations about books. And I'd made friends with her. And poor lady, I met her not long before she died with some fearful diseases in the oldest collection. It was about 15 years ago, 30 years ago. She was still very charming. She was a great niece of Bergson, Morgan's.
Oh, yes. Yes, I think Jonathan's told me that.
Very likely.
And she died of Alzheimer's. She died of premature senility.
She died of brain tumors, too, and things went wrong in her head.
Yes.
Not just Alzheimer's. I mean, she suffered all the pains. It wasn't just her husband was a psychoanalyst, as you know, called Dr. What is his name? Miller. I think she must be psychoanalyzed by him. You see? And he was a member of the Reform Club when I was there. And he used to talk to him about his wayward son, Jonathan. He hoped he'd be all right, but I didn't meet him then.
Yes.
He used to consult me. What to do about his son. I didn't like him, the psychoanalyst.
Why?
No, he was rather vulgar looking, with a mustachio, and had a kind of slightly self-conscious, slightly thrusting Jewish air, that I've always disliked very much.
Yes.
So I have a strong streak of anti-Semitism in me. I have no Jewish vices, more obviously than general vices.
Yes.
When Jews have specifically Jewish qualities, I mind that more. I feel ashamed and hostile. Was he? What was his name? I think it was a boy. Yes. I didn't know where he came from, what he was, but he married this lady. Was not happy with him.
Yeah.
What his relation was, I didn't know what John's relation to his mother was.
Difficult to fathom. Difficult to fathom. We talk a fair bit about it, but it's hard to register.
She was very sensitive, very, and extremely, and understood poetry very well.
Did you feel drawn to her, attracted to her?
Not physically, no. Not physically in any way. Mm. Not the reason. She was not at all handsome.
Mm.
But even that not, she wasn't physical at all. She was, took no interest in sex at all.
Yes.
Consciously.
Do you remember whether your closest friends at St. Paul's were Jews or non-Jews?
Well,
one of them's a clergyman,
I'll tell you, no, that was love, no doubt. But, no, at prayers, the non-Christians, not non-Anglicans, were herded together into the art school where our names were called by roll call. The others were to prayers, which comes to the same, there was a man at the door taking names, so he couldn't escape one or the other fate. Who were late, you see, that was a crime. The Jewish boys, therefore, saw each other in the morning. They were all held together and naturally made for sat next to each other for 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, whatever it was. I did have Jewish friends, yes, among them. But they were not my only friends, no. My Jewish friends I had, I suppose, three Jewish friends, you know. And
one of them Shapiro?
No. No. He wasn't a good friend of mine ever. He was 2 years old, I knew him very well. I never completely liked him. He never completely liked me. We were on friendly terms. He was very jealous of me in some funny way. Because he thought that I was, you know, somehow he worked harder. He was more English than I was. He thought I was rather a foreigner. He was very pleased to be born in Glasgow. I was slightly snobbish about all that. And I got a scholarship at Oxford, he didn't. And then my parents had a certain amount of money. His father was completely feckless and lost any money he was ever given. He was a charming man who played the flute. His mother was the daughter of a minor rabbi in Glasgow. And therefore there was always slight tension. We talked to each other, of course. And we were quite friendly. He wasn't exactly a friend. I can't say that. There was one thing which did draw us together, and that was that we both hated these the rather smart Jewish synagogue we went to, because we thought it was very artificial, insincere, and top heads and awful. So at one period, he and I, he was 17, I was 15, let us say, used to go to little East End type Jewish synagogues around the Portobello Road. Well, we both obviously experienced some kind of religious emotions, which one does at that age. And that we liked. So we went together, and all these Jews were East European Jews, and they prayed in a very sort of intense, rather corybantic sort of way. See what I mean? Yes. And they shook, yes. And they shivered, and they rolled, and they screamed, and we thought this was a real article. You really believe. And that moved us. And that was the closest friendship period, friendship with him that I ever experienced.
Was that also the only period in which you experienced religious feelings,
yes,
or temptation?
Yes, yes. I was taken to synagogue by my parents, but I was very bored. I didn't hate it. It's exactly like the Church of England. One had to do it because one was Jewish, but not much importance attached to it. And I was bored stiff. These long, boring prayers. And see, I must have prayed in my life. I don't think I'm conscious. I never believe in God at all. Prayer, yes. Identification with the Jews, yes. Jewish history. I knew quite a lot about that, always. Because in Russia, there was a little Russian Jewish periodical written in a sophisticated manner, which we subscribed to, which told stories about Jewish heroes of the past. Exactly like children's books. I mean, the...
This was in Russia, that period.
Russia. I absorbed that before I was 10.
Yes.
You see.
And
that
stayed.
Yes. So I knew who the Romans were, and I knew who the people who rose against them were, and I knew who King David was, and I knew what the first and second temples were, and I knew roughly what the Talmud was. All that I knew very well. And that was very firm. But I suppose I never talked about this. Now, the Jewish friends. One was a man called Ettinghausen, who was a German Jew. His family came from Frankfurt. His father was born in England already. His uncle went to the first performance of Carmen, a Jew in Paris. Told me about it in great detail. Charming man, Uncle Toto. The father was my wife. Yes. The father was a bookseller, a thing called Mag's Brothers, which was rare books. And he was brought up in Jewish piety, violent anti-Zionist, but pious, strict, tribes not. And then came Hitler, and at first he didn't believe it was real, and then he realized it was a self-state. And total German type transformation occurred, became 100% Zionist. Then, little break, as with the Germans, exactly like being a Nazi suddenly. And he never got a fellowship at Oxford, but he was a lecturer in German. In those days, there were not many Jewish fellows or colleges that also I can tell you about. But I was struck, the only one I think of one time, literally.
Really?
Yes. And not quite the straight line. And he then went, of course, to Palestine immediately, blamed me severely for not doing so, changed his name to Eitan, became head of some foreign office school, got into the foreign office, became Israeli ambassador in Paris, married quite a rich wife, became head of the Israeli broadcasting system, and is still alive in Jerusalem.
But started Adams and Paul's with you?
Was exactly that period, I suppose.
Yes.
So he's followed St. Paul's too, before him.
Yes. Is there anyone else from that period still
yes.
alive?
Yes, surviving.
Yes.
No, there was a man called Halpern, who was only half Jewish, whose father was a Zionist financial official, mother was English. And he was beautifully educated in a superior fashion by his father. And he was St. Paul's and me. And then we came to Oxford, did get a scholarship, and then married the niece of Lytton Strachey. I was killed in the Battle of Britain as an airman. And in his papers, he described himself as growing the Church of England, which was rather awful, but he didn't.
Yes.
And that was vaguely embarrassing. But when he emerged after he died, after he was killed, he was the second Jewish friend. The third Jewish friend was a kind of lunatic. He's called Marmorstein, son of a teacher at Jewish College, of a very eminent sort of theological teacher, who, large, fat, quite an amusing man, who told one infinite obscene stories of every kind, homosexual, heterosexual. He was Hungarian by origin. He read Hungarian gallant literature of the 1840s. He went to Cambridge, I think, then he was Oxford, and then went to Iraq as a teacher in Alliance Israelite School there, and remained tremendously pious and violently pro-Arab, and still is alive. He was the BBC's Arab expert. His hatred of Israel was frantic, absolutely pathological, because he was not pious and
yes.
was secular and so on.
Yes.
But he's a bit touched. I mean, he was a little crazy. But he's much admired by all the pro-Arabs, regarded as a great man by them. He was, in fact, abnormal, still is. I remember him well. I was fond of him, and if I met him now, I'd be quite nice to him. He grew an enormous beard, if you see what I mean, and vast, great, fat man of an eccentric kind. He learned Arabic, and was a great Arab propagandist, and a great denouncer of Jews, Palestine, Zionism, and all that. So I haven't seen him lately, but the last 30 years. His brother was quite normal. And ordinary bourgeois, very family. He was my other friend. But he used to fill one's, not just mine, used to tell people fantastic stories about affairs which went on, frightfulness, awful homosexual friendships, enormous indecency and obscenity, wrote obscene verse. Then on the non-Jewish side, I had at least five intimate friends, both, all of whom disappeared in my life. There was a man called Stevenson, who was son of a bank clerk. I used to go and stay with him in vacations in boarding house. He was a bank clerk's son in Eastbourne, Brighton. There was somebody called Whitley, who was son of a barrister, whom I made great friends. There was, who was the one of others? Yes. There was somebody called, they used to bring teas, I say. They were real intimate friends, and more intimate than the Jews, all the two, broadly. I enjoyed that company more, and so on. I was talked to them about ways, many ways. He wasn't very Jewish, to my point. I was, but I wasn't.
Yes.
I mean, I didn't feel out of water in any way, separate from the country. There were about two others. Yes, there were. There was a man called Maurice Ashley, whom afterwards became the dominant editor of the Listener, who was a great friend, but whom was older than me. We drifted his life, we drifted apart. He was a friend. There was, who else was there? That sort. There was somebody called Patterson who became an archbishop in Africa. So I was in excellent terms. Became a clergyman. I felt absolutely easy with him.
Yes.
I felt no barrier at all.
Yes.
Less so than any other Jewish boy I knew.
Yes.
You see what I mean? I mean, absolutely none at all. They knew what I was, I knew what they were. It never came up.
I'm wondering, we've talked quite a bit about your mother's attitude towards her Jewishness, and one gets a very strong Jewish identity. What about your father?
My father was born in a middle-class Jewish timber merchant. He was a Jew, he knew other Jews, he went to synagogue, he took some interest in, knew a certain amount about Jewish history, he brought up piously. He was not a Zionist, nor did he mind it anymore. He took some interest in his own family, told me all about my descent, which I think I told you was from this founder of the Lubavitch dynasty, that he knew. He knew all the details of that, who was who married whom. But his attitude was very, very, what's called relaxed. I mean, if I had married a Gentile, he wouldn't have minded very much. He would have thought it might go wrong, and was never sure. Jews marrying Gentiles, and then sometimes it didn't work. My mother would have minded very much. She would have put up with it, or she would have minded.
Interesting.
Because I drifted apart. She would have minded, she would have put up with it, because my life took such a different turn than this.
Yes.
Once I was at Oxford.
Yes.
Not even as a don, I mean. He was an undergraduate. My life has lived so differently. My friends are all different. My interests were different. But although I lived a very warm and cozy, perfectly friendly life at home, nevertheless they assumed that I was going to have a life quite different than theirs.
And they encouraged that?
Yes, yes. Anything I wanted, yes. They respected it. They believed in sort of academic life, intellectual life, all that. They respected it. They were very respectful towards it. They were in favor of it. My father wanted me to go into his business, because he wanted my business to continue, but not all that much.
So there was never a fight or conflict?
Never, never, never. No. Nothing like that.
When did your father die?
In, say, 1953.
And your mother?
She was 94 years of age.
And your father at his death?
He was 70. She was 94. Lived for many years.
Your mother lived to see you in all your glory. Do you think she was surprised?
She didn't know. No, she was surprised. She didn't know. She didn't understand the glory.
What do you mean?
Didn't know what the glory consisted in. I mean, she wasn't clear about the glorious nature of the glory. For example...
Well, you were knighted...
Well, let me tell you. My knighthood isn't... The knighthood is entirely due to her.
Yeah.
The story of the knighthood I will tell you. I was, to my great surprise, offered a knighthood by Macmillan. I was surprised and upset. I didn't want it. Because I thought it didn't fit me. I thought other dons wouldn't like it, it would cause jealousy. But then I felt uncomfortable. I was insufficiently socially snobbish to want it really. And I felt it rather like putting on a paper hat. It wasn't criminal, but it just made one think ridiculous. So I said to Aline, to whom I was married, this happened in 56, I suppose, that was a year after we married, not three long after. I think maybe the same. We were married about 55. I think. I'm not sure it's in 55 already, I can't remember. Anyway, I think 56. And I said, I'm going to refuse. I'm going to refuse it. I didn't want to do it. Would you mind very much? I said, no, I didn't mind. I didn't mind either way. I could take it or not. I wonder. Then, of course, I'm always nervous about these things. I consult people about everything. I'm not at all a decision maker. so I consulted David Cecil, my great friend, who said it would be consequence. No question. Absolutely. Can't take any reason against it. So then I consulted three or four other people, all were in favor. Sparrow wasn't in favor. He said, well, anyways, I think it quite fit you. Of course you deserve it and so on. Anyhow, it up and down it went. Finally, my mother-in-law was taking this, says, I can see that you're going to refuse it. I can see you're going to not going to take it, absolutely. You've made up your mind. Well, all right, I did then make up my mind. And then went home to London and saw my mother and thought I would tell her. They'd been offered the knighthood, she understood that, and wasn't going to take it. She looked terribly sad and said, well, you must do what you want. You must do exactly what you want, I don't want to persuade you in this direction. But tears entered her eyes, and I observed then that if I took knighthood, give her pleasure every day of her life, then thenceforward.
Yes.
It's quite clear.
Yes.
Nobody quite believes my story, but it is the truth.
Yes.
It is the truth. And I thought, well, I can't be quite so selfish. I can tell Darlene that. I said, sure, we absolutely transformed that. She'll love it.
Yes.
The nicest thing that ever happened to her.
Yes.
You see, I don't mind that much. But
why do you think it was so important to her?
Because she lived by these public values. Because if you were famous and important, you got a knighthood. You see, it's a marvelous thing to be. Knights are very important people. In our life, it's quite clear, particularly in the Jewish world. Knighthood is a glorious thing to get. There weren't all that many knights, the Jewish knights in 1956. And after that, to a penny. You see, but that's what happened. I came back, and so I then wrote a letter, first refusing, then I thought, no, I can't, I had able to stress as I wrote, I remember sitting in All Souls, I wrote a letter saying, thank you very much for this. And then I was terribly upset by doing it, and my right eye began to tremble. As a result, it was a nervous thing. It went on doing this for about 9 months.
Yeah.
It had a neurotic effect on me.
Mm.
Funnily enough, it wasn't easy. It was an absolute crisis.
Mm.
Needn't have been. I mean, it's not that important. Still, it was. And
that
then,
is to say, you felt slightly ashamed of yourself.
Yeah. Well. Yes. I felt reluctant to do it. I felt it was wrong kind of value. Didn't fit with what I believed in. Mr. Berlin was better. More honorable. Mm. I believe in equality in the world. I didn't want to take a title. I didn't want to dress up. I didn't want to go to the palace. I did none of that. The whole thing, the kind of thing I was theoretically against. I wasn't a member of the Labour Party by then, which I had been before the war, more or less. But even so.
But what about the Order of Merit?
Oh, well, my mother didn't understand, but didn't know what that was. Never heard of it.
And when did that happen?
That happened in 1960, quite early on. 64? And about 60. At that, she telephoned me one day. Well, I'll tell you what happened then. I left England because I didn't want to be telephoned to about that. We left for 3 days in Italy. And I rang up Aline, she'll corroborate, from Wolfson, which I was already the president.
Yes.
There wasn't a building that I was sitting,
yes,
in a scholar's office on those Oxford streets.
Yes.
And said, disaster has occurred. She said, what? Well, I better come home and tell you. Absolute disaster. She said, what do you mean? Someone has died? I said, no. You've been offered something. I said, yes. And then came home and said, two off. And then I remember being told by whom, by David Cecil again, saying, it's impolite to refuse. You must. But that time I didn't care enough. I thought, all right, you're all nice for you. I didn't mind a bit. Well, I'll tell you, to me, the OM really meant recognition of some kind of genius. And I thought, now, who? I thought I didn't fit the class, you see. I thought, let me see. Bertrand Russell, yes. Henry Moore, yes. G moll philosopher, yes. If I got it for you. Anyway. Who else were they at that time? Which one of one or two? You know, the limited ones at that period.
Some scientists.
Trevelyan was. Scientist, yes.
Dorothy Hodgkin was, wasn't she?
I think she may be, yes. She got a Nobel Prize about that. Yeah. Dorothy Hodgkin, certainly. Trevelyan, certainly. One or two politicians. Lord George made himself one. See. But then I saw that Lord Zuckerman was one. And Veronica Wedgwood was one. Then I thought, all right. That made it all right. You see, those two.
Yes.
I felt that absolutely nothing like that. I couldn't say, then neither of them was in the least first rate. So if they could have it, well, it'd be all right. Still never to seem indignant.
You are amusing.
Some people were. But more than I feel very irritated by it. My Lord Chester. My friend Mrs. Hart, who was a communist agent before the war, said, who've been around back in your palace lately? It was done entirely by Wheeler Bennett, who was my great friend, the historian, because he was a historical, he was a terrific snob. He's some sort of historical advisor in Buckingham Palace, and had great respect for me for some reason. Already quite admired me, and I'm sure he said people like me ought to get it. Nobody had ever heard of me, but there it was done.
Let's stop there for today.
I agree.